exciting, even encouraging, helping us to ponder what our place might be in the universe and to explore the very nature of reality itself. But there's another side to this mystery, and it's not so light. It's not so encouraging. It can be deadly serious. And it belies the image of the friendly space brethren here to watch over us, maybe even to help us on the road to understanding, you know, cute, smiling aliens like in the movie E.T., non-threatening advanced beings as in the movie Starman. This version is something closer to War of the Worlds. For 50 years now, we've been told by our government, by various governments around the planet, that UFOs are not a threat to national security. And because they aren't a threat, there is no need for our governments to study them or to take any of this stuff seriously. The evidence we'll explore tonight stabs a stake in the heart of that official canard. There are many cases, both in this country and around the world, in which there is undeniable evidence, undeniable questions about national security issues involving UFO incursions. Arguably, the most dramatic and most important UFO case ever is the Bentwaters or Rendlesham Forest incidents. And it wasn't just a single incident or like a UFO zipping around in the sky seen over only for a couple of fleeting moments. This was a series of events seen over multiple nights by multiple witnesses, and these are not run-of-the-mill country bumpkins seeing a light in the sky. These men and women are among the most trusted in our entire military for the simple reason that they were entrusted to oversee and, if necessary, to employ, to use our most powerful weapons, nuclear weapons. And the military does know that nukes, his book, I should say, is considered a classic in the field. You can check out the material in the NAPS news section as sort of a warm-up for tonight's discussion. I should also note that all the bumper music we've selected for tonight is from that time period in question, the year 1980, just to help kind of set the tone, get us into a 1980 frame of mind. Hope you like these tunes we've selected. No time to waste. We take our first break and return momentarily with my guest, Colonel Charles Hult. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. A couple of months ago here in Las Vegas, it was my pleasure to attend an event, a UFO panel that met at our National Atomic Testing Museum. They have an exhibit there, an Area 51 exhibit that's pretty cool. If you're ever in town, you should probably check it out. But this panel was incredible. It was the last in a series of UFO-related events at the museum. And the panel, it's an impressive makeup. Two of the guys who were on the panel were former heads of Project Blue Book, the Air Force's study of the UFO mystery. Another one was Colonel John Alexander, who's been our guest on this program, has a unique perspective of his own on the UFO mystery. Nick Pope from the British Ministry of Defense, who was sort of the Fox Mulder of the MOD for a couple of years on the desk, the UFO desk at the MOD for a long time. But the most impressive of the speakers, of the panelists to me, is Colonel Charles Hult. The story he told about the Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest incident just kind of blew me away. You know, we've all read about it. Anybody who's a serious student of the UFO mystery has read about it. You know the basics. But to hear someone tell it, who was there, who saw it, who went through this, and who lived with the consequences is an entirely different matter. Colonel Hult is a retired U.S. Air Force colonel, former base commander at RAF Bentwaters. He served in Vietnam, Japan, and Korea, was assigned as a deputy commander at Bentwaters, and has been a key witness in the exploration of what has come to be known as the Rendlesham Forest incidents. I just can't wait for you to hear him tell the story as I heard it. Colonel Hult, I'm really glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, George.
Let's start it this way.
My pleasure to be with you.
Thanks. I'd like to know what your, before we get into the specifics of what you saw and encountered, what was your incident about UFOs prior to this? Had you ever given it any thought at all as a subject, or do you think it was too wacky to be worth your time?
No, in fact, my involvement was partly to put the thing to rest, to debunk it. I never had any really serious interest. I mean, it was something, you know, I've heard about, I knew about, I knew there were some questionable activities, but I never really gave it a serious thought.
You ever heard it in military circles where, you know, the guys have, after you're off duty, you have a couple of drinks or something or a cup of coffee and tell stories about UFO incidents at military bases, that kind of thing? Scuttlebutt?
Well, it was quite common, especially amongst the pilots, to mention experiences, but they did it, how shall I say, in a social setting. They didn't do it officially.
You know, I was reading a book in preparation for tonight's interview, a book by a historian, Richard Dolan. It's an excellent book called UFOs in the National Security State. And in the lead up to the section on Rendlesham, he notes that there were several incidents in Europe leading up to the events that you're going to describe. There were incidents over the UK. There were incidents over the North Sea. Pretty dramatic UFO encounters in Spain as well. Had any of that come to your attention prior to the events we're going to talk about?
Yes, it had, but I never really gave it a lot of serious thought.
Well, let's jump right into it, because there are various witness accounts of what happened, different dates, and I think that in light of your position, that you are the definitive witness. You're the guy whose butt was basically on the line. So tell me the story. Did it happen? Did it start on Christmas Eve, or was it the night after, or what are the dates that you recall?
It was Christmas night, the first night. Why don't we go back and set the stage, first of all. In 1980, I was reassigned from the Pentagon to RAF Bentwaters as a deputy base commander. And the deputy base commander is sort of the eyes and ears for the base commander, to make sure that everything happens right. The base commander would give the speeches, cut the ribbons, kiss the baby, so to speak, and all that sort of stuff. And to make sure it all happened right, that was my job, to scurry around and make sure that everything fell into place, it was done properly in accordance with directives. So, that being said, also need to say, keep in mind, at that time, RAF Bentwaters was probably was the largest tactical fighter wing in the free world, and had a very key role in the situation in Europe. The mission primarily was of the twin base complex is that should the Eastern Bloc countries move west, or should they have moved west and come through the Fulda Gap, was to move forward with the A-10s and kill armor. And then the base would be backfilled by strike aircraft, which would take the appropriate weapons to the appropriate places.
You guys are basically were on the front lines then.
On the front lines. It was a very enjoyable tour. The only real frustration was the constant exercises and wearing gas masks for untold hours and all the complications that went with that, and the chemical suits and so forth. You should wear one of those masks for 6 or 8 hours and try and operate.
I'll take your word
anyhow.
For it. Am I correct in saying that they would not assign just anybody to this, that these are pretty good guys, especially if they're assigning you to the deputy base commander?
It was a plum assignment. It was a good, tremendous career potential.
So what's the first incident? What happens and when?
Well, basically, on the morning of the 26th of December, 1980, I went by the police station to talk to the desk sergeant and pick up the police blotters. The police blotters being the chronological history of everything that happened in the previous 24 hours. And we would get a copy in the office just to see what was happening on the base. You know, there was a DUI or this or that or some incident or some problems or whatever happened. And when I walked into the desk sergeant, who I knew well from going by there quite often, Crash McCabe, started laughing when I walked in. And I said, "What's the funny, Crash?" He said, "Colonel, you're not going to believe this. Burroughs and Peniston and Cabanasac were out in the woods chasing UFOs all night." His exact words were, "And the lieutenant said, don't put anything in the police blotter." I kind of laughed with him. I said, "Well, what happened? What do you know?" He said, "Well, all I know is they saw some lights and they were out in the forest. We lost track of them for a long period of time. A lot of confusion. I'm really not sure." I said, "We've got to put something in the blotter. Put in there something about the unexplained lights and that they were off the base and whatever you know." So he finished typing up the blotter. I collected them and I took them up to the office. We all had kind of a chuckle. We had a staff meeting that morning and nobody really thought a whole lot about it. Then it kind of got set aside, if you know what I mean, for the day. But I realized later in the day that, the police were just a buzz, I guess is the best way to put it, with all the talk about UFOs in the woods and strange happenings and whatnot. And I still didn't think too awful much about it until two nights later. We were having the end-of-the-year Christmas party at the Woody Bar. The Woody Bar was a Quonset hut on Woodbridge Base. In fact, it went back to World War II. If you ever saw the movie 12 O'Clock High, where they went to the fireplace and turned the mug around on the mantle, that's where that was filmed, and that actually sort of thing happened there. But anyhow, it was a family affair, a covered dish dinner to recognize people and to kind of celebrate the holidays. We just finished the main course, getting ready for dessert, when the on-duty flight lieutenant came in. He was white as a sheet. Now, he wasn't an ordinary lieutenant. This person had spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. was very mature and quite responsible and very well-liked and highly respected. And he said to the base commander and I, we need to talk privately. So we went into the coat room. It was the only private place right in that area. And he said, it's back. And we said, what's back? He said, the UFO is back. I said, you've got to be kidding me. I said, what do you know? He said, well, we went out in the forest. I said, you were out in the forest? This is the equivalent of the National Forest. It's called the Queen's Forest. He said, there were strange lights, strange happenings. We were kind of investigating what happened two nights prior because somebody had seen something again. Well, the base commander had to make some presentations and give a speech, so he turned to me. You know, it fell on me. He said, go out and put this to rest and see what this is all about. So I went to the disaster preparedness officer, and I said, who's your standby person? And they told me Monroe Nevels. And I said, have him go down to the office, bring his camera. I knew he was a professional photographer, semi-professional photographer, and get some instrumentation. I wanted him to get a Geiger counter so he could say there was nothing there. And I talked to the chief of police, and I said, any one of your senior officers or NCOs to go out with us? And he assigned Bobby Ball, who was one of the flight chiefs and a very responsible person. So I went home and changed clothes, put on my utility uniform, collected my little tape recorder that I carried everywhere, and they came by and picked me up, and we crossed Bentwaters Base and went back to the East Gate. Bentwaters out the gate, down to Woodbridge Base, and across the base and out into the forest. And lo and behold, there were probably, I'm guessing, somewhere around 20, 25 people out there, policemen. There were light alls, which are motor generators with big fluorescent lights on them, four or five vehicles, a lot of confusion, and they were having problems getting the light alls to work. They, for some reason or other, they didn't want to work properly. Well, first thing I thought was, gee, this is a public relations disaster. We've got all these people out in the forest in the middle of the night. This is somewhere around 10, 11 o'clock. I said, that's all we need to do is have the press show up or somebody make a big incident out of this. So I was quite concerned. But then they said, well, look over there. That's where the object landed two nights prior. I said, well, show me. So we went over into the forest. By the way, we did look in the area with a starlight scope, and it did seem to have a dull glow in that area. They showed me three indentations equidistant apart, something like 8 or 10 feet. They were about a foot, foot and a half across, and about 3 to 4 inches deep. So we got the Geiger counter out, and we're taking readings, and lo and behold, we get much higher readings than the background, that is, in the area, especially in the center of the area formed by the three indentations.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the readings are that, you know, they're higher than background, but are they enough to be dangerous?
No, not enough to be dangerous. I wasn't concerned about that, but they were high enough. They were 8 or 10 times background radiation. I suppose if you had laid on the ground air or ingested some of the dirt, you may have had a problem, but I wasn't concerned for safety at that point because I had been through some schooling on nuclear weapons and the fallout, et cetera. So we're taking readings and looking around, and I'm marking this is spot number one, spot two, et cetera. And I look overhead, and you can see through the area was just full of Corsica pines. And you can see they're very tall and dense at the top. And you could see an opening through the canopy directly over the site. Also, there were marks on the trees, like rub marks. We're probably there for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, taking readings and scratching my head trying to figure out, what is this? When the lieutenant looks up and says, look over there. What's that? There's a blinking light. We look over, and there's this glowing red object. The best way I can describe it is oval, very bright, had a dark center like an eye, and appeared to be shedding something like molten metal dripping off it. It's out in the farmer's field. We watch it for a few minutes. It moves into the forest, avoiding the trees, moves primarily horizontally but bobbing up and down vertically occasionally, avoiding the trees, and it comes toward us. It stops. We just stand there in awe. I'm thinking, I've never seen ball lightning. Maybe this is ball lightning, but how can it move through the trees and stay around that long? It recedes, goes back out into the farmer's field. So we move forward to try and approach it. We move up to the edge of the field from the forest, and I notice the farmer's house directly across. the light from the object, the glow, makes the house look like it's on fire, especially in the windows. Now, people have said we were watching the lighthouse. The lighthouse is off to the right about 20 to 30 degrees on the coast. We can see it, and it's on the far side of the house. There's no way the light from the lighthouse could be reflecting off the windows of the house. I was quite concerned for the people in the house. I'm thinking, gosh, you know, is there some danger or something? It's obvious they're asleep. By this time, it's probably getting close to midnight. Then the object silently explodes, just sort of like fireworks, into five white glowing balls, and they disappear. Whoa. I said, well, let's go out into the field and see if we can find any evidence of whatever was shedding or falling off the object. In other words, did it burn the ground or anything? So we went out into the field, and we're searching around and find nothing except evidence that the cattle had been there. So I said, let's move further out and get a better look. So we moved down past the farmhouse and out into the adjoining field on the far side of the house. In the process, we stepped into a small stream, managed to get ourselves all wet. Keep in mind, this is winter in England. There's a breeze blowing off the coast. It's probably about 35, 40 degrees. It's quite cold. So we're a bit uncomfortable. And while we're out in the field, somebody, and I don't remember who, says, look there, there's these objects in the sky to the north. They look like half moons. And they're moving about in a very high speed with sharp angular movements. They have multiple colored lights on them. And they turn from elliptical to full circle or full round and continue their moving, almost like they're doing a grid search. We watched them probably for 10 or 15, maybe 20 minutes. Meantime, I am making comments on my small pocket recorder. I don't leave it on all the time because of the battery life, and the tape only ran, I think, for 20 or 30 minutes. We watched the objects for a while, and then we noticed there are two or three objects to the south. One of the objects to the south comes directly overhead at high speed, up about 2,000-3,000 feet, and stops. We're just standing there looking at it, and it sends down the equivalent of, I would say, a laser beam, a very concentrated beam. It did not radiate out. It was a steady, straight beam, about a foot in diameter. It illuminates the ground 10 or 15 feet from us. Well, then I almost went into shock. You know, is this a warning? Is this a method of communication? Is this a weapon? What is this? And just as suddenly as it appeared, click, it disappeared. But the object stayed in the sky. One of the other objects moved over the base at Bentwaters and sent down similar beams, which looked like they were landing in or near the weapon storage area. Now, keep in mind, we have three different radios with us. I'm on the command net with all the senior officers in the command post. One of the people with me is on the law enforcement net, and one is on the security net. And we can hear the chatter on both those radios that there's something happening over on Bentwaters Base. People are seeing things, too. While this is going on, I called the command post, and I said, would you call Eastern Radar? Eastern Radar had responsibility for air defense of that sector, and see if they can find any. Here's where I see things, and I describe where they are in the sky. The command post comes back and says, they don't see anything. Bentwaters Tower doesn't see anything. We've even talked to Heathrow. They don't see anything. Well, I'm really puzzled now.
Colonel Holt, I'm going to ask you to stop the story right there just because it's getting good. I'm sorry that music tells us we need to take a break. We'll pick up the story and get into the consequences. They were severe for the colonel and his men right after this. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come. Talking with Colonel Charles Holt about the amazing events that he personally witnessed, he and others, at RAF Bentwaters back in December of 1980. We pick up the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Colonel Holt, you're describing a series of amazing events that are unfolding before your eyes, these strange craft flying around in the sky, these odd lights performing amazing maneuvers, radiation detected, indentations on the ground, radio chatter from other witnesses. Are you at any point thinking, we need to call in the cavalry, we need to get reinforcements, call in some jets, have them fly over here and take these things out? Are you worried to that point?
Actually, I was, but my concern was the command post didn't seem too excited about the whole thing. And what I later learned is that not only did Eastern Radar pick up blips on their screen, our air traffic controllers in the tired Bentwaters, and this didn't come out until after they retired, actually saw the object, saw it go past at high speed, had it on their scope, and saw it go into the forest where we were. Now, the reason they didn't come forward is because they knew other people in the past, other air traffic controllers who had reported UFOs, and they got decertified. So they made a deal between the two of them that they weren't going to say anything. There was also a senior officer, an aviator, was in the tower with them, and he doesn't want to talk about it. So it was confirmed by two different radars that there was definitely something there, and more witnesses have come forward, more police witnesses that were other places on the base that actually saw something too, including the tire operator in the weapon storage area. There's a tire there to oversee the weapon storage area. So there were multiple people that saw things and saw them go into the forest and saw the activity in the air.
The idea that it's a lighthouse or lights from the town or any of the other ridiculous explanations that have been offered by skeptics, debunkers, and others, it's insulting, isn't it, when you have so much physical evidence, multiple witnesses, radar sightings, indentations, the radiation, the rub marks on the trees. I mean, a lighthouse doesn't do any of this stuff.
It sure doesn't move through the forest, I can tell you that. It sure doesn't explode into multiple objects, and it doesn't send down laser-like beams from the sky. So what can you say? I think that some of the skeptics are motivated by different things. I suspect some of them are motivated, manipulated by agencies. Others are just very naive and do not want to believe there might be something, some other intelligent thing out there. Well, let's go back to the story. Now,
sure.
I did make the tape recording. So I had the tape, and I ran into the wing commander, who was the ultimate boss on the base. The following morning, I went into the office, and we shared a common building. There was a hallway in between, and his office was on the left coming in, and ours was on the right. And I talked to him briefly and told him about the tape, and he said, let me have the tape. So I gave him the tape and the recorder, and he took it to the Third Air Force, which was Air Force headquarters in Mildenhall for all of England, and played it for the general officer there, senior officer, and the staff. And the general said, is Hulk credible? And my boss said, yes. So he turned to the staff and said, well, what do we do? And there was silence. So his answer was, well, it happened off the base, so it's a British affair. So I was nervous the whole time my boss was gone with the tape, wondering what's going to happen. Keep in mind, I'm eligible for promotion, and this is not exactly what you would call career enhancing. So he came back and threw me the tape recorder and laughed. I said, well, what do I do? He said, get with Don Moreland. Don Moreland was the liaison officer for the RAF. He was assigned to the base. And do whatever he needs. So Don was in Wales for the holidays. It was Christmas time. I had to wait till he came back, hence the memo I wrote, which is it's not in the public domain now, wasn't written until several weeks later. And there was some confusion on the date because I put the date the morning of it happened, not the night before. That's how the confusion all started, I think. Anyhow, when Moreland came back, I said, well, what do you want? He said, well, write me a memo. So I kind of cleaned it up and abbreviated it, called it unexplained lights or something to that effect, and described basically what happened. And he sent it off to MOD. Unbeknownst to me, he sent a copy to his boss, who was the liaison at 3rd Air Force at Mildenhall. Now, keep in mind, it got very quiet for 2 years, and I was very pleased. You know, it all sort of went away. I didn't want this thing. I didn't need this kind of publicity. And a young man who was, how shall I say, a wannabe that was on the fringe of things, perhaps, came forward with a story to a writer by the name of Larry Fawcett in the States and made a big issue about it. Fawcett came into the base under the Freedom of Information Act and asked for a copy of anything that was available. Well, there was no official copy. The only copy that was available was an onion skin or a carbon copy that I had. We didn't keep it. I mean, we didn't have a formal investigation, so to speak, because it was a British affair, keep in mind. So Fawcett was told we didn't have any records, which we really didn't have any formal records. So he heard from someone and they threw the grapevine that there was a copy of 3rd Air Force. So he went to 3rd Air Force for the Freedom of Information request. And a good friend of mine was the acting 3rd Air Force commander, Pete Bent. And Pete called me up and says, I have a copy of this memo. And I said, how did you get it? And he explained. He said, I'm going to have to release it. I said, please don't. I said, if you do, your life and mine will never be the same. He said, I'm going to have to do that. Well, he released it. And almost immediately I met BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, local radio station, Radio Orwell, German TV, Japanese TV, and Lord knows who, many other people descended upon me. And my comment was, no comment. I really didn't want to be involved. I even had the News of the World. You've probably heard of them recently.
Oh, yeah. They're
now
sure.
out of business. Sort of an equivalent National Enquirer pop up and say, we'll do an exclusive story and we'll pay you well. And they made me an offer. I said, So I went to the JAG, the judge advocate, and said, how do we accept this? Can I accept this and donate it to the Air Force Aid Society, in other words, the charity? He said, you can't do that. Well, they ran the story anyhow. And I knew they were coming to the base. So I went over to public affairs where they keep the biography and on all the senior officers. And I pulled my file. Unbeknownst to me, they pulled my boss's file and put his picture on the front page of the News of the World. And it said, UFO lands in Suffolk, Air Chief confirms, or something to that effect. And, oh, my goodness, things just went wild after that. In the meantime, I had made a copy of my tape and given it to my then boss because he wanted to hear it. He left it in the desk drawer. His replacement came in and thought it was funny and was playing it at cocktail parties for British friends and making copies. So suddenly my tape was in the public domain, too. So what can you say? Kind of caught up in the whole thing. So I pretty much ignored the whole thing as best I could, and it somewhat died down until in 1991, I believe it was, I was approached by Unsolved Mysteries and wanted to do the program. At that time, I was heading up the inspection director for the DODIG. Well, I was very uncomfortable with the thought of doing it, but I went to my boss. I talked to the DODIG, and I said, I've been approached by Unsolved Mysteries, and he said, sit down and tell me about it. So I described the whole thing to him. I spent there probably about an hour telling him everything that I could think of that happened. He said, go ahead and do it. So I did the program.
Another well, let me ask you this, then. If they say, go ahead and do the program, and there were no real obvious ramifications immediately for you or your career, the people would say, well, there's no cover-up. They let them talk about it.
Well, I don't think the DODIG, just like I think very few people in high places know actually the whole story or what's going on. This is something that's very close-held. It's a very compartmentalized program, whatever it is, wherever it is. When I retired, I was debriefed because I've been involved in some pretty serious things that way beyond top secret, things that we inspected in the DODIG, especially it had to do with satellites and imagery and all sorts of other things I can't talk about. But so I said to my debriefers, they said, you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that, so on and so forth, which all made sense. And I said, how about Bentwaters? And he said, Bentwaters. I said, you know, the UFO incident at Bentwaters. And they looked at each other and said, what's that? And I told them briefly what happened. They said, yeah, there's no problem there. So I was free, really, to talk about it, what happened at Bentwaters.
Were you aware of what was going on with other lower officers, lower subordinates, Burroughs and Peniston, those guys? Were you familiar at the time?
I was definitely not informed. I was very naive and very trusting. What I found out years later when they actually came forward is that four of them were hauled in, British and American operatives, if you will, not from the base, actually administered probably sodium pentothal injections and hypnotized them and really messed with them something big time.
Why didn't they do that to you?
That's a very good question, probably because of my rank. And I think what they did is they found a patsy in one of the guys to put out enough disinformation about little green men and about repairing the craft with parts from our avionics shop and all sorts of other way out things. In other words, disinformation. You can't cover the whole story up. Too many people knew. So what you do is you make it so ridiculous everybody laughs at it. And they're very skillful at this, I have to tell you. And it's very close held.
Well, let's talk big picture stuff now from the perspective of many years later. Do you think that there is sufficient evidence that this is from somewhere else? Was it a threat?
I'm not sure it's a threat. I really don't. I can't answer that threat part, but I can tell you what we experienced was under intelligent control. There is no doubt about that, no doubt whatsoever. And I'm firmly convinced it was very thoroughly investigated in the background. I had British friends tell me that the people that lived in that area were, interrogated. I talked to the forest. There was a Forest Service office not far from there, and the forester lived there and some of his staff. And they told me some men came around in trench coats asking silly questions and so forth a few days after that. So I'm firmly convinced that it was investigated. Now, the British have recently released all supposedly their UFO information. There is a gap. And Nick Pope, who you talked about earlier, having been in Las Vegas with us and amongst other places, will tell you, too, there's a gap. The material from that time frame is missing. And the other interesting thing is what they released is they've released what people have seen. They have not released the results of any investigations or what their thoughts and comments on the thing are. So, yeah, they've been very forthcoming with some things, but they haven't told you the whole story, believe me.
British Ministry of Defense said, we never really did much of a study because it wasn't a threat to national security. And I guess in one sense, maybe you could say it's not a direct threat. There wasn't an attack. They didn't fire killer laser beams at the weapons. But I would think that anything unusual, unidentified, floating around outside a nuclear base would be considered a matter of national security.
Well, Lord Hill Norton, who was former Secretary General of NATO, formerly the equivalent of our Secretary of Defense for the MOD, tried desperately to get to the bottom of the thing, and he couldn't get there. I talked to him personally, and he's gone on record. Now, he's recently passed away, or two or three years ago. But he came on pretty strong. He even got the Parliament and demanded some explanations and didn't get anything.
Looking back at it now, your take on, do you have any guesses on where this was from?
No, I have a strange feeling because I've been back in the area four or five times doing programs and just meeting some old friends and whatnot, people that have, you know, taken this very seriously in England. And quite a few of them, and they may have something to it, that area there is a portal from somewhere, another dimension, another place. There's something about that area because there's so many sightings and so many different strange happenings. Now, keep in mind that area is quite unique in the sense that not only what we had at the base as far as weapons, but the sizable nuclear plant was just up the coast. Butley Village is probably a mile or two away, and Butley Village is the home, supposedly, of British witchcraft. Could that tie into something from somewhere else? Also, just down the coast was RAF Bodsey. RAF Bodsey is where all the experimental radar was during World War II, where we tried to pick up and quite successfully did the German bombers coming in. So there's a lot of things in that area. I have some friends, I guess you would call them, that have gone back, and they repeatedly see strange things there. And an awful lot of the locals told me after the story broke that, oh, we've seen, well, this is common. We see these things all the time.
Well, there was a series of incidents at Lake and Heath Bentwaters back in 1956 involving RAF and U.S. Air Force personnel as well. I don't know if you ever heard of that after you started looking into this stuff.
I did. Now, you know, I'm not what you call a UFO buff. I mean, I don't subscribe to any magazines, belong to any organization, but I've had an awful lot of people come to me with telling me similar stories. Even high school students that went to we had a K through 12 school on the base. The high school students that went out in the forest one time partying and ran into something strange and frightened half to death. I've probably had 30 or 40, maybe 50 people come forward with stories about things in that area. So,
give me your impression.
I'd love to have answers. I don't have any answers.
Talk to me about cover-up issues. You know, we've heard so many conflicting stories. It was clear that Burroughs and Peniston, a couple of those guys, were messed with, as you mentioned, that there was physical evidence for this case, radar evidence, a lot of credible eyewitnesses. All that stuff went somewhere. And I just wonder if you think that it's an active cover-up. I know I heard your comments here in Las Vegas, whether it's still going on. And if so, who's doing it?
I'm firmly convinced there's a very tight, small, compartmentalized group, agency, whatever, that uses CIA, NSA, OSI, DIA, all the variousness under the FBI. They feed information, I'm firmly convinced, they feed information in. They don't get feedback. They do some of the legwork, the investigative work, but there's somebody somewhere, an organization, that collects all this and has a handle to a certain extent on this. I'm not saying that we have a group that's in, how should I say, in touch with extraterrestrials or anything of that nature, but there's a group, a small, very select group, that has a good deal of information about what's going on.
Talk to me about the debunkers who have surfaced, and it seems like every year a new one comes forward to explain this stuff away. Your frame of mind when you start hearing some of the explanations for events that you saw yourself. You had to be mad about it.
Oh, you know, I've sat down with some of them, especially one particular one in England, and a well-known supposed astronomer in England. And he and I have actually sat there and had a drink or two and discussed this at great length. And there's no way I'm going to convince him. He's either on the payroll of somebody or just adamant about I saw a lighthouse. I did see a lighthouse, but I also saw something else at the same time.
It's that they don't want to believe it. They don't want to believe it.
Well, there's no way I'm going to convince him, I guess. So, you know, let him think what he wants to think. I kind of put it on the shelf. If somebody such as you comes along and says, what really happened, and you're credible, I'll tell them the story. But I'm not going to sit down and debate with these people, because when you have a closed mind, there's no sense talking with someone like that.
Anyone ever come to you and tell you to button your lip, just shut up about it, don't talk anymore?
I've only had one instance where I thought I was being debriefed. Right after the incident the program with Unsolved Mysteries, I actually got a visit from the senior staffer for Senator Byrd. I'm sure you know who Senator Byrd was.
Sure.
He probably had more clout than anybody in Washington at that time. And he was trying to follow the trail to find out who was doing what and where the money was coming from. In other words, to do the investigation. He knew something was going on. And I spent a lot of time with his senior staffer trying to help him.
The guy's first name is Dick, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, we know him. Yeah, I know. I spent some time with him myself. It was a very sincere effort on his part to go around the country and talk to people about what was going on.
Oh, yes. And I did everything I could to help him. And about the same time, I got a call from an Army colonel who's still on active duty at that time, John Alexander. And John says, I'd like to come up to Washington and sit down and talk to you. I said, where are you coming from? Well, Los Alamos. Oh, a Sandia Laboratory. Oh, interesting. I'm into non-lethal weapons. Whoa, that sounds very exciting. So John and I sat down. That's the first time I met him, and I'm still convinced that that was my debriefing, if you will. We bantered back and forth, and we left friends. But to me, it felt like a debriefing.
Well, I should tell you that John Alexander, I spoke to him, and he speaks very highly of you. He's impressed with your testimony and thinks that the case is legit and is a genuine case, an unexplained case of with the clear national security implications.
We don't agree. He's firmly convinced that there is no cover-up, and I'm firmly convinced there is, and I've told him. You know what I told him. I told him publicly.
Right. Colonel, I don't know if you can stick around for maybe 10 more minutes. I wanted to ask you for 10 more minutes. I want to ask you about consequences for you, because although you've been able to speak publicly about it and it was threatening to derail your career, it didn't seem to have happened. And if you wouldn't mind just hanging around for a couple more minutes, and then we'll be joined by Robert Hastings. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Colonel Charles Hault. I should tell you, Robert Hastings, author of the seminal work UFOs and Nukes, will join us in about 10 minutes. But Colonel Hault has agreed to stick around for just one more segment to answer a couple of important questions. Colonel, thanks for staying a couple of extra minutes. What about consequences for your career? I know we read that, I've read that it had the potential to derail your career, but it didn't. Have there been consequences, though, for you?
No, I was very fortunate. I guess it was just luck and timing, because the incident didn't come out until after the promotion board had met. If it had come out earlier, it probably would have caused real problems.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
One thing I didn't get a chance to mention earlier is when I was with the DODIG, we did an organizational inspection of DIA and NSA specifically. And right about the time we were starting the NSA inspection, an airman who was at Bentwaters, who was probably responsible for bringing the story out, and I'm firmly convinced it's part of a disinformation effort. But anyhow, he called me and told me he was going to blow the whistle on NSA. He didn't know what I was doing at that time. And he was going to do this, he was going to do that, because NSA had denied him reenlistment in the Air Force and so on and so forth. So I told my team chief, who was doing directing the NSA inspection, I said, you need to tell your counterpart out there, if they know anything about this guy or have any involvement, it's time to either come clean or do whatever they need to do. In other words, you get ready for something in the Washington Post. Well, that didn't materialize, but what did happen the very next day is I got a call from the chief of the Compromise Division at NSA. And it was a very probing conversation. He wanted to know what I knew and all the details, and he kept trying to tell me that he knew nothing about it, but he sure had a lot of details and knew an awful lot about it. So they obviously knew who he was and knew what was going on. I thought that was interesting.
Do you think that somewhere there's a room full of secret documents, tapes, radar readings, photos, things of that sort? Somewhere there's a great big stash of this stuff? And if so, if it exists, who controls it?
That's a very good question. You know, numerous times I've been told or asked in public forums that, you know, the government should have an agency that investigates these things and controls this and looks into this thing, and we should have that. And I said, we do have. You just don't know about it.
You think that somewhere, somewhere, whoever it is that is the keeper of the secrets, that they have the answers, that they understand this, or it's still a, sort of a mystery to them as well?
I think somebody has a very good understanding of what's going on. And the material, as you say, it isn't just locked in one big room. There's obviously some stuff out in New Mexico. There's obviously some things at the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I suspect the agency is that, how shall I say, oversees and controls and releases that what they want to release is probably located in Washington.
And I imagine it's highly compartmentalized. It's a very small group of people.
Yes. Oh, yes. You have to understand how that works. I'm firmly convinced that probably the only president that knew about what was going on was probably Eisenhower and George Bush Sr.
You think it's something that is ever revealed to the public? It's a mystery that can be solved, that will ever be told, whatever it is they know?
Well, I think there's an actual effort now to gradually, how shall I say, introduce the fact that there may be something. I just get that feeling. Nothing I can put my fingers on for sure. But I have a feeling there's just been enough information leaked out and things are coming out that in the information age, it's pretty hard to keep everything secret. I mean, let's face it.
Makes you wonder what the NSA, the guys that were talking to you, what they did with that information, what file that was put into.
Yeah, very interesting. I'd love to read it. I'm sure there's a file, probably a very fat file at this point.
Colonel Charles Hult, I really appreciate you coming on the program and sharing your recollections with us. If you ever have any trouble, anyone comes knocking at the door, I hope you'll let us know and we'll come to the rescue if we can help you.
Well, what I've done is I've buried 3 or 4 tapes. I sat down years and years and years ago and made detailed tapes of everything, and I've buried them a few places.
So is there more that hasn't come out?
No. What I mean is if something happens to me.
Okay. Colonel, thanks very much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're quite welcome. Good luck.
All right. Thanks. And we'll take our break now, come right back with Robert Hastings, author of UFOs and Nukes, to talk about this case and many others at U.S. nuclear facilities. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Robert Hastings is a UFO author and lecturer who has researched declassified U.S. government documents to what he calls confirm UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites. From as far back as 1948, he's interviewed somewhere in the neighborhood of 130 or more former servicemen with some amazing stories, and has worked with Colonel Charles Hult. Robert, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with Bentwaters Rendlesham. Help me characterize this case, how important it is in the pantheon of the kinds of cases that you have investigated.
Well, I consider Chuck Hult, he goes by Chuck, to be a friend. He certainly is courageous for having come forward and revealed what he has revealed. You may or may not have picked up on the fact that he's not entirely comfortable with talking about the nuclear weapons aspect of the case. One of his initial comments to you was, we were going to send in A-10 aircraft to destroy Soviet armor had they invaded Western Europe, and then there would be appropriate backup using appropriate weapons. And those appropriate weapons, of course, were tactical nuclear weapons. The weapons storage area that he alluded to was the largest tactical nuclear weapons storage area in Western Europe during that era. People who are very familiar with one aspect or another of the Rendlesham Forest case I find the vast majority of them are unaware that this nuclear weapons storage area was sitting on the edge of the forest. As I have sort of snidely said to people over the years, the craft that landed in Rendlesham Forest, it wasn't there for the occupants to get out and pick mushrooms. It was quite clearly part of an operation involving the craft that later hovered near the weapons storage area and sent down laser-like beams into it, according to the chatter that Chuck Holt heard on the radio. So the nuclear aspect of this case and many others is central, whether people realize that or not. I made it a point to, it took some time, but I was successful in locating and interviewing the two air traffic controllers that Chuck Holt alluded to, Ike Barker and Jim Carey. I had them on audio tape, and as of this past May, got them on camera describing in detail what they witnessed in the tower. That is key to what is going on as well, because these gentlemen, these professional air traffic controllers, each independently told me they picked up a bona fide UFO. There was no question that this was not a conventional aircraft of any kind. Of course, any human memory is fallible to some degree, especially when you're recalling events from decades ago. So each of them had slightly different recollections of some aspects of what occurred. But empirical data, radar data, is empirical. It's not anecdotal. What these gentlemen said they saw unequivocally on their radar was this: an unidentified aerial object the night that Chuck Holt was out in the woods with the team. They picked up an object that basically covered 120 miles in some 8 to 12 seconds, and that's based on the number of sweeps of the radar beam where this object was on the screen. Jim Carey, in particular, remembers this object coming in from basically the east, crossing the screen, and then retracing its step, but before going off the screen, doing a hard, instantaneous right angle 90-degree turn. No aircraft on Earth can do that. Ike Barker, on the other hand, does not recall seeing this right angle turn on the screen. However, he did look out the window of the air traffic control tower for the brief interval where this object hovered momentarily, and told me that he saw a spherical shaped object, bright orange in color, with lighter either lights, or he laughed and said maybe even portholes around its, let's call it, equator, since it was spherical shape. And he said it was hovering just beyond, from his vantage point, the Bentwaters water tower, and he estimated it was roughly twice the size of an F-111 fighter bomber. And he said the thing that impressed me the most was it instantaneously went from a hover to a rate of speed that he had never seen any aircraft perform. So what you have, you know, unequivocally, finally, decades later, are persons who can say not only were people seeing lights in the sky from the ground, but at least one of these UFOs was, in fact, tracked on radar, performing in a manner that no aircraft on Earth can achieve. That's quite a new development and important development in this case,
I would say. And also, you've got the testimony of the radar guys. I mean, obviously, they are not picking up something from the lighthouse.
Correct. I've interviewed probably over a dozen persons altogether who were at Bentwaters in one capacity or another, guards at the weapons storage area, radar people, communications squadron people, who were describing their knowledge of the case. And every one of them, I think, sarcastically dismissed the lighthouse theory that has been advanced by a notorious debunker named James McGahey. And so the people who were actually on site, including the radar operators, I think Ike Barker, one of the controllers at one point, said, I don't know what I saw, but I can tell you it was no damn lighthouse, and he laughed. So they all think that that theory is absolutely absurd.
It's insulting, isn't it, to these guys, to somebody like Chuck Holt, to come up with an explanation like that, or some of the other bogus explanations that are tossed out over the years?
Well, and I think there's a whole range of reasons for why those people say what they say. The world is filled with armchair experts on every subject under the sun. UFOs are no exception. Persons who have all the answers, even though they've studied none of the facts. persons who've never taken the effort to interview the witnesses firsthand to look at the documents, but nevertheless have concluded that UFOs don't exist and therefore it has to be anything but a UFO. And Chuck also alluded to some people being fronting for agencies. I think quite clearly that's going on. People who are presenting themselves as scientific skeptics, but if you dig below the surface, as I have with one leading group of skeptics, we can get into that discussion later. They all had links, key members of the group had links to the nuclear weapons program, and you have to look high and low to discover that fact.
Colonel Hult alluded to the idea of disinformation, people purposely muddying the waters. Would you say that that is definitely what occurred here, that some of the people who have even been considered key witnesses or among the key witnesses in that case were embroidering their story a bit just to muddy the waters a bit?
It's hard to say. I mean, I agree that there have been efforts to deflect the facts and muddy the waters, as you've said. He didn't name this person specifically, but I will, Larry Warren. Larry Warren has made claims. He was a security policeman at the time. No one else that I've interviewed, including Chuck Hult, Colonel Hult, endorses Larry Warren's version of events. And whether Larry Warren was making these things up wholesale or was being directed by someone to do that or some other explanation for his story not fitting with anyone else's testimony, I don't presume to know. I simply know that all the people that I've interviewed, security policemen, Hult, others in a position to know what went on one way or the other, none of them say Larry Warren's story has merit in large part.
Talk to me for a moment about consequences. You know, Colonel Hult seems to have escaped any serious consequences for speaking openly about what he saw, and yet he recounted the stories of the other two airmen in particular who were hauled in and thrown in a chair and shot up with drugs and hypnotized and I would assume threatened. What do you know about what happened to the other guys in this case? And how credible is the evidence?
I will simply say that I have had private conversations via email with Jim Peniston and John Burroughs, two of the individuals in question. I am not going to specifically go into detail in terms of what they told me in an email because I've not gotten their prior permission to do so in this type of forum. However, it's already a matter of record that Jim Peniston, for example, said there were OSI, Office of Special Investigations agents there, but they were not the local agents. So someone presumably from Washington flew in and was involved in the interrogation. Jim Peniston has also said, and Chuck Hult alluded to this, that there were British intelligence agents taking part in the debriefing. Now, the British government has been doing what quite clearly, in my opinion, is a sleight of hand. They've been releasing documents, as Chuck Hult said, low-level UFO incidents, things that were already known to some degree or another by the British public. But key information, including apparently British participation in these interrogations of the Bentwaters witnesses, no documents alluding to that or corroborating that participation have been released. That is an ongoing cover-up, quite clearly. So I can say at least that much, that these people were very seriously interrogated. Chuck Hult said that he did not know about these things until much, much later. I don't think I'm going to say anything more about that in terms of what Peniston and Burroughs have communicated to me privately.
When you look at this case in retrospect, you know, we'll get into this later in talking about skeptics in general, but the statement is always there's nothing to study when it comes to UFOs. There's no physical evidence. We don't have a cigarette lighter from a flying saucer. Look at this case. You got the indentations, the radiation, the eyewitness statements, the radar readings. Seems like there's a heck of a lot of substantial stuff that could be studied and evaluated if somebody wanted to do it.
Well, that's correct. And the persons who have their minds made up that there's no validity to the UFO phenomenon will engage in all manner of intellectual gymnastics to explain away all of that physical data. But for an average fair-minded person who wants to know the facts, has no strong convictions one way or the other about the reality or non-reality of UFOs, if one objectively looks at this physical data, again, these empirical data, radiation traces, radar evidence, and so forth, it's clear that we have something other than a lighthouse or a psychological fantasy. One other aspect that was mentioned, Charlie Waters was a security policeman at the weapons storage area. I interviewed him, I believe, in 2007. He said that while he was at the weapons storage area, he did see a UFO quite close to it, not directly over the weapons storage area, but in the adjacent woods. And I have a standard question that I ask witnesses who I interview. I say, you know, since UFOs in large part are circular or spherical or disc-shaped, I say, if you held a dime out at arm's length, would what you saw be larger or smaller than that? I asked that of Charlie Waters, who was on security patrol at the weapons storage area. I said, is this UFO that you saw about the size of a dime? And he thought a moment and chuckled and said, it was the size of a cantaloupe held at arm's length. I mean, this thing was either quite large or quite close or both. And he said he thought what looked like a small rod extending from the bottom of it. He did not see a beam of any kind, but this was the same evening that Halt was hearing over the radio, Colonel Halt, reports of security personnel at the weapons storage area seeing one of the UFOs sending down beams of light into it. So you have that eyewitness at the weapons storage area describing quite clearly something in the sky above the forest, not that through the trees, a lighthouse, mistaken lighthouse, but quite clearly in the sky. Charlie Waters also told me that there were in the adjacent farms, he could hear livestock just going crazy. Just, you know, all the barnyard animals were just in hysterics. And that is a widely reported phenomenon worldwide where you have, if there are animals present during a sighting, they sense something in their environment. Who knows whether it's a high-pitched frequency or some sort of other phenomenon that humans can't really detect with our senses. They just go nuts, and Charlie Waters was reporting that. So I have jokingly said, you know, to, for example, psychologists who say that people who see UFOs are just creating stories, fantasies to make their lives more enriched. So my response to them was, so what do we have here in those cases, fantasy-prone cows?
Yeah, crazy cows. Robert Hastings, author of the seminal work UFOs and Nukes, is my guest. We continue our conversation about national security implications of some of these UFO nuke cases right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Robert Hastings, author of the seminal book, The UFOs and Nukes. And when we come back, we continue our conversation about the Rendlesham Forest incident. A couple more questions on that, and then we expand it to the larger body of work about other scintillating incidents at other U.S. nuclear missile bases. Stay with us, everyone. More to come on Coast to Coast. Robert Hastings, you know, some people have referred to the Rendlesham Forest incident as the British Roswell, and I guess there are similarities in that there were UFOs allegedly involved in both of them. But, you know, beyond that, there really aren't a whole lot of similarities. It was big and it was important. And, you know, the Ministry of Defense over there had said, we didn't really study it because it didn't have national security implications. And I would like you to address that for a moment. The idea that something was flitting around outside in the trees outside this base didn't seem to interfere with anything, the operations of the base or the weaponry. But would you say it does have national security implications?
I think quite clearly it did, and again, you have to remember that official pronouncements by the British government or the American government regarding UFOs, their take on it, their interest in it, and so on, has been a smokescreen from the get-go, in particular in America, where you had an effort to quell public interest by saying we had Project Blue Book, they found no evidence that UFOs affected national security, put national security in jeopardy. Therefore, we closed down Project Blue Book in 1969. Well, a lot of the public bought that story. A lot of them went, no, something more is going on. Well, the Freedom of Information Act has clearly established that other groups within the government picked up the mantle and, in fact, had been involved with national security-related incidents for decades while Blue Book was doing more superficial investigating and more public relations than anything at the end. So Chuck Holt touched upon it. I will say again that these releases of information by the British government over the last few years, in my view, are a smokescreen. The low-level stuff, the stuff that the public already knows about, is being addressed and released, the implication being, you know, we're telling you all our secrets. Well, again, persons who were at Bentwaters say that the British government, the intelligence agencies, were involved in the interrogation of witnesses, and yet you don't see any documents or any official acknowledgement of that being released by the British government, nor will you. So that quite clearly, if you know, you have national security implications, quite clearly that no one is going to officially acknowledge.
As Colonel Holt mentioned, the Ministry of Defense has been having these document dumps. Here's all our files on UFOs. We have nothing to hide. You can read the stuff. But coincidentally, they don't have the files related to this incident. That time period is missing. Not a coincidence, right?
That's correct. And Nick Pope, who worked for the Ministry of Defense, has acknowledged that debunkers have attempted to discredit what Nick Pope has said, what others quite clearly have said, that there is a gap in the released documents relating to the Rendlesham Forest incident. Now, I can also tell you that in Scotland, the one and only nuclear missile carrying submarine base, Faslane, has had sightings that I'm aware of. I've gotten civilian reports of people living in the area of quite clearly UFO activity at this one and only nuclear missile submarine carrying base in Scotland, and yet you don't see any documents released by the British government. So they're engaged in sleight of hand. I have a whole chapter in my book called Look Over Here, Not Over There. Magicians do what's called misdirection. While they're performing a trick over to the right, they're saying things and doing things with their hands to direct the audience's attention in another direction while the trick is being performed somewhere else. That's precisely what the U.S. government and the British government is doing with regards to, here we're releasing all the documents, folks, when in reality there's much more going on behind the scenes out of public view.
Well, we'll touch on that again a little bit later when we expand the discussion. You know, you mentioned that you just interviewed these two radar operators. After all these years, and it's amazing, I guess, to somebody not familiar with the UFO field and how this stuff works, but that there are still witnesses out there to interview who haven't really come forward.
I got an interesting email within the last 24 hours, and I won't say more than that because the individual is reticent about having his name used. But, you know, there are, quite clearly what he's told me is credible. It dovetails with other information I have from the mid-60s time frame at a certain missile base that I won't identify. And so unless, you know, this individual does agree to work more closely with me and allow me access to his military records to verify that he was at a certain place at a certain time, I really can't do much with that story. But yeah, there are lots of witnesses. I would, since you have such a huge audience on this program, I would be foolish not to ask ex-military personnel in the U.S., but any country for that matter, with a knowledge of or having been involved in nuclear weapons-related cases, to contact me at ufohastings@aol.com. My website is ufohastings.com. Unless someone gives me permission to use their name, that name will never see the light of day. But I'm trying to build a database about credible and regarding credible cases involving nuclear weapons. So I would encourage people who have been carrying around stories, have been holding experiences close to their chest for decades, to contact me and join the ranks of the 130 persons that I've interviewed already, including Colonel Holt, who, in my view, are courageous patriots. They believe that there is a higher calling than military secrecy. In America, we have a democracy, allegedly. And the question is, if all this is going on, if UFOs are real, and if whoever are flying them are decade after decade monitoring and sometimes tampering with our nuclear weapons, is that a secret that should be kept from the American people and the rest of the world forever? Clearly, I don't believe so. And these very courageous men like Colonel Holt, who've come forward and gone on the record, don't believe so.
Well, we will come back to that through the course of the evening's discussion. Before we leave Rendlesham, though, as I mentioned, leading into Colonel Holt, Richard Dolan had written about this, that in the months leading up to the Bentwaters incidents, that there had been other UFO incidents and reports there in Europe, over England, over the North Sea, in Spain. Have you looked at those as well?
I'm aware of them. I have not specifically looked at the cases that he has mentioned. What I would put the incident at Rendlesham Forest in the context of our other incidents at weapons storage areas around the same time frame. In 1975, October-November time frame, weapons storage areas at Loring Air Force Base, Maine, and Wirtz Smith Air Force Base in Michigan were visited by UFOs, and there are documents released through the Freedom of Information Act to verify that. I also have the testimony of two persons who were at Malmstrom Air Force Base, including the commander of the helicopter squadron, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Pizer, who confirmed in a very cursory fashion that a UFO hovered above the Malmstrom weapons storage area in the same fall 1975 timeframe. So some 5 years before what occurred at Rendlesham Forest, or the Bentwaters weapons storage area, there were virtually identical incidents of UFOs hovering above other WSAs. Beyond that, at Kirtland Air Force Base, the Manzano weapons storage area, there are documents indicating that something very similar occurred in August of 1980. To sort of finish this train of thought, when the Soviet Union collapsed, as you well know, since you went to the former Soviet Union and really were instrumental in having documents and witness testimony come forward regarding Soviet nuclear weapons-related cases, UFO cases, it's known that in July of 1989, according to KGB documents, at a place called Kapustin Yar, which had a intermediate range nuclear missile capability and a weapons storage area on base, these KGB documents say that some 9 years after the incident at Bentwaters, several Soviet personnel saw a disc-shaped object with a dome race in, hover above the Kapustin Yar weapons storage area, send down laser-like beams on one of the buildings in the weapons storage area, tracing circles, two or three circles. The beam apparently moved in a circular fashion on three occasions before this thing raced away. Now, that document did not come to light until the mid-90s, I believe, and yet it's virtually identical to what Colonel Halt was hearing on the radio when he was out in the forest with his team, that persons at the weapons storage area were seeing a disc-shaped object sending down laser-like beams. So this is going on, and both the superpowers during the Cold War have experienced this. So it's quite important, and, you know, what's being described by persons at Bentwater involving the weapons storage area is not unique by any means.
Well, I know that there were Lake and Heath Bentwaters incidents back in 1956, as I mentioned to Colonel Halt, involving the RAF and the U.S. Air Force as well. And he sort of expanded that conversation to say there's a lot of weirdness in that area, in that forest, allegations of witchcraft, discussions of portals. And I wonder if you worry when you expand the conversation to that level, whether it goes too far, that it's too much for a skeptic or just someone in the public with a healthy interest in these topics, too much for them to buy when you take it that far.
I listened to the first hour here, and I heard him say that. I've read that online. I have no way of knowing, the veracity of any given account about odd experiences going on over time in Rendlesham Forest. I can simply say that I've read the same things that Chuck Halt alluded to. So I don't know what else to say about it. I, of course, having been involved in this for 40 years, have my own opinions about one thing or another, speculation, theorizing. But I think it's important that that be put on a back burner, and that given that I have focused so much on nuts and bolts aspects of the phenomenon, incidents involving clearly physical objects, tracked on radar sometime, near nuclear weapon sites, I just focus on that aspect of the phenomenon. A moment ago, you mentioned Richard Dolan talking about other incidents in Europe, and it occurred to me that in 1977, at a place called Fischbach, which was an Army tactical nuclear storage weapons storage area. I interviewed a former military policeman, an MP named Jack Phillips, who was there in 1977, some 3 years before the incidents at Rendlesham Forest / Bentwaters. And he said that a UFO, a disc-shaped object with a dome, came in one night, hovered over the Fishbach weapons storage area where tactical nuclear warheads were stored for the Pershing missiles. This object hovered momentarily, suddenly became much brighter, and as it became brighter, he said all of the power went out at the weapons storage area, all the alarms came on. Meanwhile, this object races away at blinding speed, quite clearly, this was a UFO event at a tactical nuclear weapons storage facility. So, again, in the context of these other events at the Air Force bases that I mentioned just a few moments ago, what happened at the Bentwaters WSA is not an isolated incident. It's certainly, one of several that occurred over a 5-7 year period.
Recognizing that you are a nuts and bolts guy, you like to deal with key eyewitnesses, official reports, documents, things of that nature. Humor me for just a second, and I promise we'll leave this alone. But looking at the big picture, I wonder if you are comfortable in sharing with what you just alluded to, your private speculation, if you want to call it, about what's going on here. I mean, because I've been chasing around this UFO stuff for a long time. And it's fun to sort of speculate and think about what it means, but it does go to the heart of some pretty big questions. Our place in the universe, who these visitors might be, the nature of reality itself. Do you allow yourself to go that far?
Oh, on a daily basis. But again, what I say to people is I'm not sure that my opinion is any more valid than anyone else's. It's hopefully predicated on the nuts and bolts data, and so maybe I do have a bit of an informed opinion that the average person on the street might not. But when all is said and done, I think the answers to the big questions are just beyond reach, let's call it that way. But in my book, I have two chapters. One is called Visitors, in which I allow myself to speculate about the nature of the UFO phenomenon. I've concluded that these are visitors from somewhere else. And if one looks at the reports of what I confine myself to in terms of eyewitness accounts by law enforcement personnel worldwide since 1954, cops have everything to lose and nothing to gain by coming forward and saying they saw a landed UFO with little creatures walking around it. And yet worldwide, over the last 50, 60 years, there are hundreds of cases involving cops, whether town policemen, state policemen, county sheriffs, who have independently in many, many different countries said that they saw on patrol late at night, usually, a landed UFO with entities walking around it or sitting visible through windows of the landed craft. If one considers those stories, which are anecdotal, to be valid, some percentage of them, one can say that these reports, that the morphologies, the physical descriptions of these beings vary widely. You have some that are described as 3 feet tall, your classic grays, for lack of a better term. You have some that are described as 8 feet tall, somewhat human. Some are quite clearly not human. Again, if there is any validity to these accounts by these law enforcement personnel, then it suggests to me that we have multiple visitors from elsewhere in the universe who may have entirely different agendas. Some of them may be interested in monitoring and tampering with our nuclear weapons for one reason or another. Some may be engaging in genetic experimentation, as has been described by UFO abductees. Some may just be passing through. We're a pit stop from their world to some other world. There's any number of scenarios that could be advanced if indeed we have multiple races here. Now, the other chapter in my book is called Warped and Hyper, and it involves theoretical physics look at faster than light travel. For 100 years or so, science collectively said, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, nothing having mass could achieve the speed of light, let alone surpass it. The implication being that even if there are advanced alien races out there, the distances between their worlds and ours are so vast they could not possibly get here, certainly with not the, the frequency of coming and going in terms of what UFOs are reported to be doing, seemingly coming and going in waves over a several decade period. So traditionally, physicists have said, even if they're out there, these aliens cannot get here. Well, in this chapter in my book, I interviewed a number of leading theorists about who are engaged in faster-than-light travel theory, and present. You know, these are people who have had papers published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and most people, even in the scientific community, are unaware that there's a growing consensus of opinion among these theorists who teach at Harvard and Yale and Columbia and Oxford and so on, that faster-than-light travel is indeed possible. If there is even one race in our galaxy that is advanced to us by 100 or 1,000 or a million years, they can probably get around the galaxy with relative ease. And again, based on these anecdotal reports by law enforcement personnel of different types of entities, I suggest that we have several races who have that interplanetary travel capability.
Or from somewhere else. I mean, you know, there are other exotic explanations we can get into a little bit later. I want to ask you to expand on what their interest is in nuclear facilities, nuclear missiles, nuclear bases. I mean, we're going to go to a break here in, I think, less than a minute, so it's a little bit too much to chew on. Tell me this, though. Your book, as I've mentioned, I think it is one of the classics in the field. You're working on a new version?
There's a second edition coming together at some point. I don't know when it's coming out. There's other projects that we can talk about on others on the other side of the break that are more immediate. And I will simply say to the audience that if one goes to my website and goes to the document page during the break, one can see a number of documents indicating UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites going back at least to December of 1948.
Well, we're going to jump into some of those cases right after the break. Our conversation with Robert Hastings, author of UFOs and Nukes, continues.